From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. It is no small challenge taking care of people with dementia, Alzheimer's. It's hard on the economy, up to $215 billion a year and rising. It can break the hearts of loved ones and grind down professional caregivers. And it's no walk in the park for the man or woman who's losing track of the day-to-day, but still has their pride, habits, emotions, now babied and even disciplined, sometimes strapped to a chair, medicated into even deeper confusion. This hour on Point, we're looking at a better way to deal with dementia, deal with Alzheimer's. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Families, caregivers, what have you seen? Can we do better? How? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. 5 million with Alzheimer's now, that number set to nearly double in the decades ahead as boomers come into their later years. It affects many people and will affect more. Here's the sound of just one, Supreme Court Justice Sandra Day O'Connor, testifying 5 years ago yesterday before the Senate Special Committee on Aging. The nation's first woman Supreme Court justice, she retired from the bench so that she could look after her husband who had Alzheimer's.
I'm here in the position of being a caregiver. My beloved husband, John, suffers from Alzheimer's. He's had it for a long time now, and he's not in very good shape at present. This is a really difficult disease because it has no cure as yet.
And it remains really difficult. How's it feel? What's it like? Here's one interpretation from the 2006 movie Away From Her. Julie Christie plays a woman slowly succumbing to Alzheimer's. Here's a scene where she's sharing an intimate dinner with her husband and two friends. She stands to pour everyone some more wine and then is lost, apparently confused. After a long pause, she speaks, explaining to those around the table with her what it's like.
Half the time I wander around looking for something which I know is very pertinent. I can't remember what it is. Once the idea is gone, everything is gone. I just wander around trying to figure out what it was that was so important earlier. I think I may be beginning to disappear.
Julie Christie in Away From Her. Joining me now from Tempe, Arizona is Tina Alonzo. She is the Education and Research Director at Beatitudes Campus, a retirement community in Phoenix, Arizona, that has been at the forefront of finding new ways to care for people with dementia. Ms. Alonzo and the Beatitudes Campus are profiled in the current issue of the New Yorker magazine as real pathbreakers. Tina Alonzo, thank you very much for being with us.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
So you have received a lot of attention for going in a new way, kind of bringing a new philosophy to Alzheimer's care. What's at the heart of your philosophy that sets it apart, Tina?
You know, Tom, I really believe it's all about comfort, looking at a person in terms of what's important to them and really trying to address that and find ways in which they can find peace, peace in body, mind, and soul.
Finding comfort, even in a really uncomfortable situation. We're going to have listeners who are in the thick of this, who are caring for people with Alzheimer's, who may have done it for years. We'll have others who just have no idea. Tina, when you look around at what has been historically and recently sort of common for Alzheimer's care, what are the problems that you see? What are the paths we've gone down that may aggravate the situation rather than help it? What kind of patterns of care have you seen that are suboptimal?
Well, first, let me say I salute our heroes who are care partners for people who have dementia. It's something that's impacted my family as well. And we know that on any given day, the trials, the challenges associated with this disease can be so profound and so very difficult to bear. But let me just say that I think the one thing that's most important to recognize is that people who have dementia, so often we don't salute their skills and ability. Certainly, dementia does impact the person in so many ways, but there are still parts of them that exist. There are still abilities that they have, and we need to be able to salute those abilities, bring those out, and really focus on those rather than all of the discombobulation and disability that's associated with their struggles to think clearly.
Skills and abilities, these are not words I think that people associate with dementia. I think we associate the loss of skills and ability. What do you mean?
Well, I think what I really mean is that regardless of how impactful in a negative way dementia is, the brain is still resilient. We don't lose all of our faculties at once, generally speaking. They erode over time. And during any given point of a person's experience during the progression of dementia, there are still ways in which we can bring the person forth. We can salute what is important to them. And we also know that for people who have trouble thinking, they still remain experts on their own comfort. So the part of the brain that really determines comfort is still intact. And we can help the person do for themselves what they would like to do if they could do it independently. And really, we've learned over our time that comfort is really non-negotiable for people who have trouble thinking, because it's truly the way that human beings desire to live, regardless of whether they have dementia or not.
Comfort is not the word that comes to mind. I mean, when we think about sort of classic images of dementia care, and they're not pretty, but, you know, it can be sort of drugged up and warehoused and bossed around, and even when people get aggravated, and they can, strapped down. I mean, that seems like this sort of old school, unappealing model.
Well, Tom, I like to quote Maya Angelou, who always says, when you know better, you do better. But the point is, people are constantly trying to do things for and with the person with dementia that they think are in their best interest. So it's well-intentioned that we try to do different things to keep them safe, make their lives pleasant. But we haven't always really taken into account, again, that they remain experts on what really matters to them, and that there is a sense of self that is retained regardless of how confused the individual gets. And so I think this is an opportunity really to explore. You know, when we look at Webster's definition of comfort and we really look at the synonyms, the synonyms of comfort are like to soothe or to console. And when you think of somebody who is slowly losing that sense of self that your movie clip so beautifully described. Mm-hmm. If you're losing a sense of self, here's an opportunity for us to really kind of pull that self forward if we attend to it, if we look at ways to create that sense of I want to be here and I want this to be the very best experience it can be.
So what have been the traditional care practices that have gotten in the way of soothing, consoling, honoring, even in dementia?
Well, and I think, again, it goes back to we were trying to do what we thought was best for people. So we may have given them medication that could have calmed them. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work. And frankly, sometimes it makes you more confused, so it causes a whole host of other additional problems. Or in the very early days, we did used to restrain people so that they couldn't get up and move. The problem with such practices is really we're pre-wired to move. We're pre-wired to be self-protective. So if things don't seem to make sense to us, we react most of the time either out of pain or fear rather than being connected and being able to reason our way out of, you know, well, this is going on because of this, that, or the other thing. So that we often see people who have dementia, we're trying to treat the symptoms rather than really looking at who they are and pulling that person forward and really finding out what their needs are. It comes down to really meeting their needs, really trying to anticipate their needs before they become problematic for the individual.
Medication, restraint back in the day, and maybe still some. Are there dignity issues when you get into dementia? Are people beyond that? Is there a range? Is dignity a relevant factor here?
You know, I would almost say, you know, to all humans, rather, whether they have dementia or not, I think dignity, respect, you know, common courtesies remain important to us through the entirety of our life. You know, so many of the patterns that we establish in our youth, they continue with us throughout our aging years. So regardless of whether the person has trouble thinking or not, all of these things always work. They always make sense because they're really a part of who we are, you know, as people.
How many patients do you have at Beatitudes?
Well, we serve 650 older adults across three levels of support. So we serve people who reside independently, folks in assisted living, and the folks in our healthcare neighborhoods.
And in your dementia or Alzheimer's unit, how many?
We serve about 60 folks under our assisted living umbrella and then also under our healthcare.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour about a kinder, gentler, more respectful, maybe more successful way to care for people with Alzheimer's, with dementia. Tina Alonzo is with us from the Beatitudes campus in Tempe, Arizona. She joins us from Tempe. The campus is in Phoenix, where they have 650 older adults in residence and 60 in their dementia unit, which has received national attention for its approach to dealing with this chapter in many people's lives. Tina, just to lay it out, what's the distinction you make between dementia, Alzheimer's? Do you use these interchangeably? Do you make a careful distinction? What?
Well, you know, there's many different kinds of dementia, Alzheimer's being the most common. So dementia is the broad umbrella of illnesses in which people have trouble thinking, ones that result in continued decline until death. So we know that it's a terminal condition, and then Alzheimer's being the most common form of dementia.
We've got Stefan writing in here from Oklahoma City. He says, I lost my father in August of last year to early onset Alzheimer's. He was a physician, succumbed to the disease at the age of 69. The journey of caring for him at home and transitioning into a memory care facility, quotes there, was emotionally exhausting. We relied heavily on the resources of the Alzheimer's Association, yet the experience was such uncharted territory. The expression that best sums up what happened with my father, Stefan writes, was a long goodbye. Is that your experience, Tina?
You know, and it's interesting, but early onset dementia impacts my family as well. And so I understand, at least to some degree, the devastating nature of this kind of dementia. And, you know, we know that sometimes people live a long time with early onset types of dementia, and sometimes they don't. And I think regardless of the length of time that you have with the person, there's a good deal of loss and grief associated with the experience. And it's wonderful that Stefan was able to rely on the Alzheimer's Association. It's through partnering with other organizations and individuals in the community that have made the journey, made the trip with someone who has dementia. I think we learn from one another how to best keep ourselves sane and really rise to the occasion as care partners.
Can you lay out for us very concretely some of the practices that you've developed and honed at Beatitudes that take us into maybe a new path for care here? Give us a very practical sense of what you do that maybe historically has not been so widely done.
So we re-examine the goals of any person, and we look at, okay, if comfort becomes the goal, then how do we make each experience that the individual has the very best, the most comfortable, the most rewarding it can be? And we use a couple of different philosophies to create that kind of experience. The first thing that we want to do is really know who this person is, and not in terms of just their medical condition or any kind of physical ailment they have, but rather looking at all the dimensions of need that may occur for the individual. We're looking at social, emotional, spiritual, all of the intellectual, all of the things that can impact a person during their lives. We want to know who they are, and then we want to try and anticipate their needs.
You mean like what their interests were when they had all their facilities, what their...
Certainly. Hmm? Certainly. What their interests were, what they were proud of, what made a difference to them.
What do you do with that information?
Well, if I'm going to salute who you are and mm-hmm. really respect you as a person, then knowing that you were a night watchman or that you were a nurse or a teacher is pivotal information when I'm talking to you about you and your life and the contributions that you've made. It's really pivotal.
Okay. So you can talk with them or address or recognize when these things come out.
Exactly. But knowing them also means that I know that they get cold easy. Or they don't, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. how they like their coffee,
mm-hmm.
How they like to sleep. Are they night owls? Are they early risers? And then trying to just let whatever is important to them be how they live their lives so that we don't force them to wake at a time that's uncomfortable or make them go to bed before it's time.
Lots of places have a fair amount of routine or even kind of discipline or regimentation around their residents. What about at your facility?
Well, don't get me wrong. Routine is very important. But routine specific to the individual is where this is at. It's not my routine that matters. I don't need to make sure everybody is in bed by a certain time, because really what we're doing is really trying to construct something that makes sense to this individual. And we know that fatigue is such a challenge for people who have trouble thinking. So the more rested they are, the better it is they're going to be able to cope with whatever may be going on in their experience.
Food. You've sort of thrown off the requirements there. I mean, you carry chocolates. You say they're better than Xanax for people, and they can eat whatever, whenever they like, even at 2 a.m. Why?
Well, let's just think about it. If you get up in the middle of the night, might you go and raid your refrigerator? You know, it's common for us when we're not, say, within the walls of an institution to go and just do whatever makes sense to us at the time. So we may go get a midnight snack, or we may make a full meal in the middle of the night if that's something that we want. Why are people with dementia different? Why shouldn't they be afforded the same kinds of opportunities that anyone else would, frankly, take for granted?
Drugs. Lots of anti-anxiety, antipsychotic drugs have historically been given. You're moving away from those, I guess, to the extent that you use them. They're more about drugs for pain or depression. What's the way here?
Well, again, if someone is comfortable, my good colleague, Dr. Gary Martin, always taught us, if someone is comfortable, then they're not going to resist your care. They're not going to be self-protective. So if we really pay attention to what makes sense to this person, even as we're assisting them with some of the more challenging things, such as dressing and grooming and bathing, if they're comfortable, then we will be less likely to see the kinds of dementia-related behavior that result in instituting any kind of psychotropic medication.
Even bathroom habits. An awful lot of facilities will just put people in Pampers and let them go. What's your pattern?
Well, we usually call them briefs. But the truth is, one of our oldest, most well-ingrained memories is about using the toilet. And there's a certain amount of dignity that is really specific to that. And it's interesting, but gravity works wonders. And often when people are escorted to the toilet and they sit on the toilet, you know, past habits just take over, and they're able to use that. And what a dignified experience for someone who may not even realize that they needed to go until they got there.
How does it change the atmosphere of the whole place for that to be the pattern? And what about the labor required for that? I mean, do you have to have a higher ratio of staff to resident in order for all this to work out?
Well, let me address the first question, and then I'd love to talk about staff because, you know, I'm honored to work with some of the most amazing people on the planet. But what this does, I think, is it creates a sense of calm. So you don't have folks who are calling out or folks who
change
sound
my,
distressed.
Change my briefs, you call them, yeah.
Or help mm-hmm, me, mm-hmm. which is such an often heard phrase. And so it really brings a sense of peace over the neighborhood when people are comfortable. You know, we often talk about it being the sound of comfort, and it's a quiet sound with laughter and people talking and things moving at a pace slow enough to make sense to the people who have difficulty thinking. And really what occurs here is magic in terms of this individual's experience, and they're really able to have the best quality of life when all of their needs are met and they're comfortable.
We'll look at cost and staffing in a moment. Let me get a couple of callers in here, if I may, Tina. Tina Alonzo sure. with us from the Beatitudes campus in Phoenix, Arizona. Ken's calling from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Hi, Ken. Thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. Thanks for another impactful show. I lost my parents in 2011. Each one of them had two different types of dementia. Dad had Alzheimer's and Mom had a Parkinson's related Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
My wife and I and my sisters, you know, were you know, we worked as a team to try to take care of them. We kept them in the home as long as we could.
Mm-hmm.
But there reached a point when they were just, even with round the clock care, it was dangerous to have them in the house. They were turning on the oven and the stoves. And I think the, you know, going through that whole process has certainly changed me and my family, you know, forever. And you have to have a sense of compassion and also a sense of humor when you're dealing with someone who has dementia. You know, occasionally you'll get a flash of who they used to be, but, you know, it's a completely different environment that you're in. And I think you just have to go with the flow as much as possible. We ended up putting them in a specific memory facility, a dementia facility that was a locked facility, but they had the ability to go freely to and from their room and interact with the other residents. And it was a very dignified environment. And like your panelists said, that the people that work there in general are just amazing human beings.
Ken, what did you find? Tina asks us to help people with dementia maintain their sense of self, to respect it, to reach out to it. Was that possible in your case, or could you still see that sense of self?
Absolutely. Mom, you know, my mom was very paranoid. That was something that went along with her dementia. And, you know, we talked a lot, to her strengths and her history, and we talked a lot about, you know, focused on her, you know, the way things that she saw the world and talked in that way. My dad was an architectural engineer and an incredibly bright guy. And, you know, we talked about, you know, we never talked down to them. We never, you know, talked as if they didn't understand what was going on. And when they were having a very bad moment or time, we just went slow and slowed down. You know, Dad, but you got to understand there's multiple types of, you know, dementia patients, some that when they go down this path, they get very angry and agitated. And some, like my dad, I call his factory default setting was happy-go-lucky. You know, he was a very happy-go-lucky guy, and no matter what was going on, he was happy. You know, so we were very blessed in that.
It's a big learning curve and that your family's taken and many, many others. Ken, I appreciate very much your call from Fort Lauderdale. Tina, stand by in Tempe, Arizona for a moment. I want to get some perspective on this kind of change that's coming into this arena. Mary Mittleman joins us right now, nationally recognized Alzheimer's researcher, professor of psychiatry at New York University's Langone Medical Center. Joins us today from Peramola, Spain. She's at a big international conference on Alzheimer's. Mary Mittleman, thank you very much for being here.
Well, thank you, Tom. I appreciate your inviting me.
So here we have a national challenge already in front of us and set to grow very substantially in the years ahead. Beatitudes is working on some new ways of addressing this. What do you know from research, Mary, about the outcomes here? Tina's got a very strong sense of how this ought to be done and some very positive feedback, but is there research that says, yes, this makes, I don't know, happier or longer-lived or more contented people?
Well, I think the research research on caregiving and on people with dementia suggests that individualizing whatever treatment you provide is going to create happier staff as well as happier caregivers and happier people with dementia. So just for example, I think that there's some evidence now, and there isn't enough because there isn't enough research on non-pharmacologic interventions, but there is some research that suggests that music that is individualized to the preferences of the person can be very helpful both in nursing homes and at home. I think that what we have to remember is that the people with dementia are individuals with their individual likes and dislikes, some of which persist through the dementia, and music is something that lasts until music appreciation and even ability to create music lasts longer than most other cognitive functions. But I think that what Beatitude seems to be really focusing on is creating something that is more like a home and less like a hospital. And I think the traditional nursing homes were patterned after hospitals, and it's very hard for a normal person to be in a hospital, even for a short period of time, and it's much harder for a person with dementia to be in a hospital-like setting. So to the extent that they can create a setting that is more home-like, more respectful of their individual desires and their individual needs, I think the person with dementia will be better off, and the family members will be happier with the situation and perhaps more likely to visit because they see a happier person with dementia.
Mary, I'm reading here a New York Times story just from last week, Paula Spann writing, that a lot of nursing homes are putting in special units for people with dementia, but that studies are finding mixed results there, that they want, yes, get them out of the overstimulating kind of general population, maybe into a separate wing, but that it's not necessarily producing optimal results. What about that front, Mary?
Well, I think that it requires special training on the part of all the staff to understand how to interact with a person with dementia. And sometimes what staff will consider to be resistance to care, from the perspective of the person with dementia, they don't understand why they're being approached for something because they do have a cognitive problem. And so they appear resistant. They don't know how to communicate the way they used to be able to, especially in the later stages of dementia. So they may scream or resist or become agitated. And so it's really important that the staff understand how to interact with the person. The idea of putting people with dementia in a special unit sounds like a good idea if the staff are trained to how to interact and to treat the people in such a way that you get the best reaction from them as opposed to the worst.
I've just got you for another half minute, Mary. Are we as a country prepared for this wave of dementia that's likely coming with us to add us with the aging of the baby boomers?
Well, we'd better get prepared because there are many more people with dementia, and that means there are many more family caregivers, and we'll need skilled family members as well as skilled paid caregivers in order to provide the kind of quality of life that we hope to have for ourselves and for our parents.
Mary Middleman, professor of psychiatry, Alzheimer's researcher at NYU's Langone Medical Center. Mary, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about a kinder, gentler, more respectful, maybe more successful way to care for people with Alzheimer's, with dementia. Tina Alonzo from the Beatitudes Campus in Phoenix, Arizona is with us, education and research director there. They have been pioneers in appealing to the sense of self, changing the setup, changing the daily routine in a way that give more freedom and maybe more face to people with dementia, with pretty good results. Ray's calling from North Kingstown, Rhode Island. Ray, you're on the air with Tina Alonzo. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom.
Hi,
Tina. My dad is 91 years old. He's currently in a nursing home, but his dementia came on about maybe 6-7 years ago, and I cared for him. And I totally agree with you, Tina. You know, you can't get frustrated when you're giving care, you have to put them in a comfort zone. But one of the things I wanted to ask you, I found with my father that I have a little dog, a little Bichon Frise, who was crazy about my, loves my father.
Yeah.
And when I bring the dog to see him in the nursing home or when he was home, he just lights up. Have you done anything in that area in terms of pets or animals to reach that comfort zone?
Let us pick it up, Ray. Tina, how about it?
You know, pets are important. Our fur babies are just as part of our family as many of the people that are born to it. And so, yes, we do have pets on the Beatitudes campus. Pets are always welcome. Pets live there. Certainly, it's different strokes for different folks. Some people love them, and you're right. Most of the time, a cute little dog coming through the door makes all the difference for practically everyone that they come in contact with. But you're right. It does create comfort. It creates connection. And certainly many of us have had a special pet, and just having a dog in our lap, being able to pet a dog, will likely make all the difference in that moment for the person.
Ray, thanks for your call. Holly in Chester, Connecticut. Holly, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
Very well. What do you know, Holly?
I'm a long-term care nurse for several years, and this is very emotional for me, but I wanted to tell one story that actually drove me to try to come up with a solution. I worked in a very upscale retirement community, and we had a resident who had Alzheimer's for more than 10 years.
Okay.
She had no family, no visitors. And she was a very combative person, and in old terms, we would say non-compliant with care, which is a horrible thing, but that's what we nurses used to have to write, non-compliant.
Yep. Yep.
Well, when I'd give my report in the morning to the nurse's aides, and I'd say, you've got Mary today. Oh, I can't stand her. She's so mean. She's, you know, she bites, she kicks, she does all of this. And I would dig through the chart to find some information on who Mary really was. Rather than the Alzheimer's down the hall, who was she?
Yeah, yeah.
After 10 years of this poor woman just being rolled over and cleaned, and I finally found a distant relative out in California, and I gave them a call, and I said, could you please, can you give me her dog's name or something familiar that I can say to cheer up her day or to make it easier? They actually told me that she had been brutally gang raped in her 20s. This is so emotional. I'm sorry to get emotional.
Yeah.
But she had been brutally gang raped in her 20s and was never able to be touched.
And you didn't know.
And here we are for 10 years rolling her over and cleaning her because no one knew what to say to her.
Wow.
And, you know, when I did pull the aides aside to tell them this, of course they cried, you know. They were doing their job. They're busy. You're going patient to patient. But it is so important what Tina is doing to understand who your patient is.
Boy, talk about an illustration of why. You put it right on the table for us, Holly.
Yep. And so what I did is I'm not even a technology person, but I put some money together and I developed this little script where if I could get somebody who is pre-Alzheimer's, I put together this script as a nurse for them to go on this interactive touchscreen program and answer all the questions that we'd need to know that Tina was talking about.
What
do you like
idea.
To go to bed early? What
do
you eat? So that nurses, when this person is admitted into the nursing home, can actually see and hear their resident as the whole person. And that's what it's all about.
And what about your combative, distressed patient there? I mean, she still needs a bath. How did you change your treatment? Did you find a way?
I'll tell you, the second you know your patient, now that these people knew that this was a person who was so traumatized, you can imagine that suddenly you're thinking about who this person is rather than it's my next resident who I've got to give a bath to.
Right, right. A little more
now
care.
Now we know the person and that gentle, loving care. And even if there is combative, you know, even if there is that, you are talking and you are loving and you are taking care of the human being rather than the Alzheimer's.
A little knowledge going a long way. Holly, thank you very much for that. Tina Alonzo, you speak about how the emotions and hot buttons of a life are still there when a lot of the cognitive may be gone. What an example this is.
Absolutely. And Holly, thank you for your service. It's only together that we're able to change the way care and service is delivered for people who have trouble thinking. So thank you so much for your commitment. And certainly we see that so many of our early experiences may impact the way we view the world. And knowing some of the importance of life events can make a difference in terms of how people are served and how they are cared for. It's a great example of knowing something that profound about a person. The one thing I would offer, and many times at the campus, we're serving people who have struggled mightily to get through the challenges of dementia, families as well as the people who are being who are experiencing dementia. And one thing that my wonderful colleague, Dr. Mary Beth Gallagher, has taught us is that, you know, often when people are afraid, using simply the phrase, "I will keep you safe, I will stay with you," mm-hmm. makes such an impact on that person when they feel like they're afraid or that they may experience harm. And so it's a phrase that I use liberally. And if someone looks like they might be scared in any given situation, then that's a phrase that we will often pull out.
I will keep you safe. Randall in Montgomery, Alabama. Thanks for calling, Randall. You're on the air.
Yes. Hello. One of the comments that was made earlier, and I don't know if you had the same person on or changed speakers, because I just turned on the radio, but the fact that you said it was said that non-hospital-like environments are, they were, most of the nursing homes are built like hospitals. Boy, that really turned on a light. But what I'm mainly calling for is, how do I find out information about this so I can help relatives that have this problem?
We'll go to that, Randall. Tina, let's go to that first. For people who are just beginning to wade in here or who maybe have been in this situation for years and aren't satisfied, what resources do you recommend?
Well, I truly believe that every organization that serves people with dementia has a personality, just like people do. And often you can easily pick up on that personality during a visit. You can always ask the staff, you know, what kinds of things would you do to help the person that I care about be comfortable and get a sense of whether or not comfort becomes the goal for everything. You can talk about whether or not sleep routines are personalized to the individual. You can ask them about how dining occurs and whether or not people have the opportunity to eat 24 hours a day. You can talk about how folks who are paid caregivers get to know the person with dementia and what kind of a team exists around that person. And the team, of course, always has to include family.
Include family. Oh, you mean it won't be staff, but just coming
not just
in and
staff,
being there.
But everyone who touches that person's life essentially has a part in the team that cares and supports them.
What about the facility itself? Randall's asking, he's saying he resonated with your, you know, make it less like a hospital. But, I mean, your place, Beatitudes, is not exactly like, a Hawaiian getaway. It's on the top floor of a large, of a good-sized building. It's got a hallways like a hospital. What makes it different? Is that important?
Well, and the wonderful thing is we're celebrating our 50th anniversary in the next few years. And so, no, we're not the newest kid on the block. But honestly, this kind of care and this kind of service can be implemented anywhere. I always say that the dementia doesn't know licensure. So the kinds of things that we're doing work in the home, and they work in assisted living, and they work in the skilled nursing facility. They work everywhere because it really is just attending to who the person is and what their specific wants and desires are. And so looking for an organization, and there are thousands across the country, in multiple different types of scenarios. The very best guidance I can always give is look for the organization that makes comfort the priority, and then have them explain to you how they would seek to deliver that sense of comfort, and how well do they work with families and with the person to achieve that goal.
Let's go to Francis in West Palm Beach, Florida. Francis, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. I so appreciate this program and the guests that you have on today. Admittedly, I'm so sad to hear, though, that this approach to caregiving has been forgotten and is being discussed as novel, because I say this because as an occupational therapist, we started working with World War I vets to help them self-actualize despite their injuries, and through the years that's been our goal, but working insurance companies and nursing homes have suppressed OTs to triage for liability or financial costs, and so the system is pushes down those efforts to help individuals, no matter what their disability, to, you know, tie them down rather than find a better positioning so that they can be free to move about.
Yeah.
I guess what I'm so frustrated that it's being discussed as something novel.
Well,
and I just wanted to know if your guests could speak to that and what we can do all as individuals in America to help this program.
Thank you, Francis. What about cost issues, Tina, how they come in here? And what about insights? I mean, I know at Beatitudes, some of the inspiration goes back to Thomas Kitwood, who in the 1990s was writing about this in Dementia Reconsidered, you know, saying that part of the problem here is that Western societies, you know, the evident frailty of people with dementia generates fear. This unease is socially managed by turning the demented into non-persons, pathologizing them. What about our cultural and our economic profile that leans against the kind of care you're suggesting, Tina?
Well, I will say that that in our experience at the Beatitudes campus, we have seen our efforts to personalize all of the care and service we deliver to be budget neutral. And so we've never had to increase the number of staff that provide the care. We've been able to always keep everything within kind of a homeostatic realm, so that as we offer food around the clock, we generally require less supplement use. So everything kind of balances out. Currently, we're engaged in some research, and our hope is to get a little bit better handle on exactly where we stand in terms of overall cost for this model of care. And I'd just like to say to Francis, you know, there are many aspects to this which are common sense and really go back to the way we cared for people when they were at home. You know, before there were nursing homes and before there were assisted livings. And so you're right, there is an element of this that speaks to times gone by and really honors that older adult in most cases, you know, for really who they are and what they deserve in terms of our respect.
Tina Alonzo, we're out of time today, but we're grateful to you for being with us from the Beatitudes campus in Phoenix, Arizona. Their whole story written up in the New Yorker magazine this week. You can link to an abstract of that article at our website, onpointradio.org. Tina Alonzo, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Tom.
The great Glenn Campbell just turned 77 in April. In 2011, Glenn Campbell announced he is succumbing to Alzheimer's. Around that time, he sat down in the studio to record some songs before it was too late. He released Ghost on the Canvas that summer, but kept on recording. And in late July, he'll release a new CD called See You There. Here he is then, and we're proud to say this is a world premiere. Glenn Campbell singing, maybe for the last time, his 1974 Rhinestone Cowboy. This is On Point.
Like a rhinestone cowboy, riding out on a horse in a star-spangled rodeo. Like a rhinestone cowboy, getting cards and letters from people I don't even know, and offers coming over the phone.
don't mind the rain, and a smile will hide all the pain. But you're down when you're riding the train that's taking the long way. And I dream of the things I'll do with a subway token and a dollar tucked inside my shoe. There'll be a load of compromising on the road to my horizon, but I'm gonna be where the lights are shining on me, like a rhinestone cowboy riding out on a horse in a star-spangled rodeo. Like a rhinestone cowboy getting cards and letters from people I don't even know, and offers coming over the phone.